From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Happy Independence Day weekend. May the freedom our forebears bled and died to gain not be squandered by leaders and others who fail to understand that in the immortal words of abolitionist Wendell Phillips, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
The real threats we face today may be from within, leaders who hate the country they govern so much.
When you really start to look at what each party actually stands for, it is clear that one party does hate America. And that party happens to be the Republican Party of the United States.
Today, the greatest threat to our national unity manifests itself within our union itself. Whether some of that is generated by external enemies matters not. In the end, tactics to stir disagreements require there to be disagreements in the first place. An invaluable new book titled How to Heal Our Divides, A Practical Guide, offers just the kind of guidance, advice, and inspiration that is needed at a time such as this, and editor Brian Allain will be with us.
Everybody say not. Everybody say not.
Not.
We are not of this world. We are not like everyone else. We are not to live in fear.
I think when we're talking about the COVID vaccine, we're talking about something that in the terminology of the Bible would be a disputable matter.
Right.
Something that there's not a clear standard biblical, every Christian would need to get it, or a clear standard biblical, no Christian should get it. And in Romans 14, which I think
the
is
toxic conflation of political ideology and religious identity plays out again and again on the American stage. Most recently, there is a significant correlation between evangelical Christians and refusal to participate in vaccination campaigns to stop the deadly and still dangerous corona pandemic. Medical ethicist Monty Self has been writing about this at Good Faith Media, and he'll share his thoughts on this week's State of Belief Radio. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. As internal divisions show the vulnerabilities in the precious democracy we celebrate this weekend, I want to take time to raise up an ambitious effort at rebuilding unity. The essays collected in the new book, How to Heal Our Divides, A Practical Guide, are not fluffy platitudes, but rather powerful meditations and calls to action with urgency and spirituality in equal measure. Such a needed resource. I'm glad we have it, and I'm joined by Brian Allain, editor of How to Heal Our Divides. Brian, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure and an honor to join you guys.
The list of contributors to this book reads like a who's who of guests that we've had on this program over the years. What criteria, besides that, did you use to assemble this panel of distinguished writers?
Well, that's a really good question. It was primarily driven by my desire to have a focus on organizations that were actually doing something to heal divides. That was the whole purpose of the book in the first place. was I felt that a country has never been more polarized, and I wanted to do my little part to try to help address that. And also during the pandemic last year, I had been reading quite a few books about different types of divides, racial divides, political, religious, sexual orientation, everything. And so many good books, but they were generally about what's the history behind this issue, or convincing you to look inside yourself, you know, to examine your own biases, all really good books, but not so much about, okay, what do we do about it? So that's why I wanted to collect these essays from organizations that are actually doing something about it. Mm-hmm. So racial reconciliation training, or political forums, or how to have better arguments, you know, how to heal the gap with our Native American, you know, brothers and sisters, et cetera, et cetera. So that was my number one priority. And I've been blessed with relationships with a lot of folks who care about those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so either, you know, asking them directly or asking them for suggestions of people that I could talk to that they know of that are doing something in this area. So as it turned out, I was shooting for something like 25 to 30 chapters. We ended up with 33.
Yeah.
And I ended up being oversubscribed within about 4 weeks of when I started recruiting contributors to this. So it was incredibly quickly that I was able to find, you know, folks who were both really relevant and had something important to talk about in this framework and willing to write a chapter and do an interview. So I'm still kind of amazed that that actually happened.
What made it seem important to take on this particular project right now?
Well, you know, this is all a second career for me. I spent my life doing completely different things, basically in high tech. And so I was a beneficiary of this incredible country of, you know, the white privilege that we enjoy for most of my life. And now I'm much more focused on trying to give back and trying to deal with some of the issues that are really difficult issues that our country needs to deal with. Mm-hmm. So from an overall standpoint, my focus has changed dramatically in that direction. Mm-hmm. But then also what I mentioned a moment ago about, I've never seen our country so polarized. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a tendency, I think, to just say, well, just write them off. They're never going to get it, whoever they are, you know, whoever the other side is, quote unquote. But, you know, that may be the anger part of me saying that, but the logical part of me says, no, that's not the right way to approach this. We've got to try to figure out how to work together and bring this country closer together again. So that was really prompted this. And as I said, the different reading that I was doing, where I was kind of feeling like, I'm sure there must be other people out there too that are feeling the same thing, that they'd like to do something, like to get involved with some organization that's actually doing something. So let me find these organizations and try to shine a spotlight on them so that other people can learn about them.
Did you know the kinds of thoughts these writers would share? I know you said that you had read their books. I'm just curious, were there some surprises for you?
Well, you know, it's just like when I do my writers' conferences, I don't tell my speakers what to say, because I feel like they're far more expert in those areas than I am. And this book was the same thing. I'm not going to tell someone that's built a company around, you know, XYZ, let's say racial reconciliation training, I'm not going to tell them what to write, because they know that far better than I do. And I guess the other part of it, too, is that I knew it was going to be 30-some different voices. It wasn't going to be one single approach. It wasn't going to be one single tone or voice or what have you. So I wasn't going to try to force fit anything like that, because I knew it wasn't practical, and I wanted their messages to shine through. That's what this is all about.
If you would talk about a couple of what you think are the most important ideas that appear in the pages of How to Heal Our Divides, A Practical Guide.
Well, that's a little bit like asking you which is your favorite child. you know, I deeply appreciate the contributions for many of the more well-known authors who contributed to this, even though you know, their chapter was not necessarily about a specific organization. Mm-hmm. I felt that that was very important to the success of the book. Was it's not just these organizations that may or may not be well known, but to also have, you know, as you mentioned earlier, some really wonderful leading voices to chime in and to support their work. So I greatly appreciated all the contributions from people like that. The second thing was that, you know, I just enjoyed hearing and learning more myself about what each one of these organizations are doing. Mm-hmm. You know, the training programs that they have, sometimes travel involved in that. It's an international set of organizations. So some of these organizations are outside of the United States that are highlighted in the book. Many of them are from the United States, but all going through experiences, leading people through experiences that I think that they can benefit from in this context.
Mm-hmm. Are there overall themes that emerged, ideas that contributors from various and diverse backgrounds clearly share?
Well, first of all, having diversity in the book was a top priority for me. You know, I didn't want this to be about any one issue or any one group of people that were talking about it. I wanted to try to be as inclusive as I possibly could. So that was without a doubt an objective in trying to assemble this. Mm-hmm. But I've learned more and more, further I've gone into different types of businesses, that the number one business asset that any of us can have is trust. And I've been very blessed that I've got really high trust relationships with some folks who, you know, were either willing to write an article like this themselves or, you know, introduce me to someone appropriate who would. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not an insignificant ask, you know, to put your name on something. Yeah. And, you know, by affiliation, you know, basically supporting it. Mm-hmm. So I was asking, you know, folks to trust me, basically, you know, mm-hmm. that this would be done well. It would be done, you know, with the right intention behind it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just can't say enough about how much I appreciate that and thankful for that. Mm-hmm. But that's how it was able to come together so quickly. This all was just an idea in my mind last mm-hmm. November. Mm-hmm. And around Thanksgiving is when I started recruiting people to contribute to the book. And here it is published in May 18th of mm-hmm. 2021
yeah.
is when the actual release date took place. So we self-published it, which allowed us to, you know, get it out more quickly than if we had traditionally published, yeah. Which is good news and bad news, right? Because then we didn't have all of the strength of a traditional publisher behind it. But I just felt like I wanted to get this out quickly because our country needs it and our people need it. And people need some hope to be able to, you know, hear something positive, get involved in something positive.
Brian, I want to ask you a question that I've tried to raise with a number of guests in recent years when discussing the frightening and growing divisions in our society. How to engage those who feel they are dominating the current situation, who feel they are benefiting from the division, how do we bring those people to the table? How do we help them see the incalculable long-term cost of short-term gain? I feel there are answers to this critical question at last in the pages of this book, so I would love to get your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, the bad news about that, I think, is that it requires a change in heart, which has got to happen on an individual by individual basis, which means, you know, it's not going to happen over social media. It's not going to happen through TV. It's not, you know, I mean, this is like a grassroots kind of a thing that you have to have a plethora of different organizations all working in the same, you know, direction, orientation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you as a person or you as a community are tied to power, whatever power you have that you're not willing to share, you're not willing to relinquish, you're not willing to give another person a break, then that's a pretty solid wall.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so at the end of the day, it's about the willingness to share power and maybe admit, like, well, you know, how we got this power in the first place maybe wasn't really all the best thing. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should rethink some of the way we've acted and thought and approach the world, and care more about our fellow citizens.
So looking at all of these people that have these ideas, I need to ask, where can our listeners buy Out to Heal Our Divides?
So we have a website. It's actually howtohealourdivides.com. So you just spell it all out in one big string, howtohealourdivides.com. You can go to the website. You can get a link to purchase the book there. You can find out about all of the organizations that have that are discussed in the books, as well as the authors who have contributed to the book. There's links to each one of the contributors and each one of the organizations. And then the book itself, you can get on Amazon or IndieBound. Either one of those two websites, I know, carry it.
Well, I can tell, anybody can tell, the enthusiasm with which you have done this and which you have about it. So in your own words, tell our listeners why they need to buy this book.
Well, I would just say that we all need to get involved. You know, we all need to pitch in. I mean, we've all been the benefit of a pretty stable society that has worked to our benefit, you know, for decades. And I know, speaking for myself, I've kind of taken that for granted. You know, I didn't have to worry about politics. I didn't have to worry about, you know, racial issues or disability issues or how we treat Native Americans or how we treat people with a different sexual orientation than mine or whatever. I didn't have to worry about that. I was able to have a life, you know, went pretty well, all things considered. And I should have dealt with all this kind of stuff earlier and helped people out more, is what my feeling is. And, you know, I hope there are other people that feel the same way.
Yeah.
That, you know, let's try to work together just to make this a better country, a better society, a better culture. This is just one mechanism to how to find out to do that. There are plenty of others. There are plenty of organizations that are not highlighted in this book that are doing wonderful things too. And I'm hopeful that I'll come out with a second book down the road where I get to highlight some more of these.
Well, this is not a one-off book publishing project. There's a podcast, a blog, and other ways the conversation is continuing. Talk about those, if you will.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. When I started this, it was just getting so much momentum behind it. I said, okay, I've got to turn this into an ongoing platform, not just a one-off book, as you said. So yeah, there's a website, there's a social media, there's weekly emails that go out. I do my own video interviews with several of the contributors to the book, as well as a podcast. And I'm continuing all those and planning to expand the scope, you know, to cover additional organizations that I think fit. In alignment with, you know, the broader mission. So that's going to be an ongoing effort.
Well, you've got a lot of irons in the fire. What other efforts would you like our listeners to know about, whether it's your work with Compassionate Christianity, Empowering Writers, or anything else you want them to know?
Well, thank you. There are really three platforms besides How to Heal Our Divides that I lead. The first one that I launched about 5 years ago now was called Writing for Your Life. And that's a resource center for spiritual writers. So I try to give away as much material for free as I can to support spiritual writers, learn about the industry, learn about writing, learn about marketing their books, things like that. But then part of that program, I also do conferences. You know, it was in-person conferences. Last couple of years, it's been online conferences. But you know, just nourishment for spiritual writers. As I began doing that, one of the things I kept hearing was that writers of color are really underrepresented in terms of the number of books get published. So I said to myself, well, I'm not an editor. I'm not an agent. I'm not a publisher. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a pastor. But everywhere I've ever been in business, so much is important about who you know and who knows you. So I said, let me start a conference series, and we called it Publishing in Color, a conference series that fosters relationships between writers of color and people from the Christian publishing industry. So that's been going on since 2018. And there's lots of book deals that have come out of that and literary agent relationships and other things like that. So that's the second platform. The third platform is one you mentioned called Compassionate Christianity, which is about a year and a half old. It's really a focal point online resource center for progressive Christians. And that there's no revenue model associated with that. We don't sell anything. It's just meant to be a, like I said, a resource center. And there are a team of volunteers who have contributed different sections to that website. There's a section on faith and science, faith and food, faith and travels. There's parenting resources, trauma recovery resources, studies about poverty, about social justice, about health and fitness. So just all offered, you know, for hopefully the benefit of folks who are interested.
Brian, I am so impressed by what you're doing and the way in which you're doing it. Thank you for all that you're doing. And I really appreciate you taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to, you know, spread the word about all these organizations that I think are doing wonderful things. And, you know, thank you for all the work that you've done. You know, your organization has been a beacon for many for years. So, you know, hats off to you all for having built that.
Up next, medical ethicist, the Reverend Monty Self. And later, some thoughts on Independence Day 2021. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Instead of bringing the nation and the world together in ways that past global crises often did, the COVID-19 pandemic has served instead to alienate many people, one from the other, and only deepen divisions along tribal lines of political and religious ideologies. Religiously driven objections to vaccinations and even to medical research, don't influence only those who hold such beliefs. They bleed into the political culture, especially when one religious ideology has dominance in our secular culture. For a look at ways this plays out and why it matters, I am really happy to be joined by the Reverend Monty Self, Senior Staff Chaplain and Clinical Ethicist at Baptist Health Medical Center in Little Rock, Arkansas. Monty, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited you're here. In your recent columns for Good Faith Media, you write from a perspective that I think is essential to amplify. Fear-driven objections to research and vaccination get transformed into dogma if we're not careful. Is that a fair way to put that?
I think it would be a very accurate way to put it. Oftentimes, going back to 2008 and even back to the 1990s, we saw a lot of religious objections to vaccination. But oftentimes when we ask questions about that, there were no rational responses. It was, I have a religious objection to the flu shot, but no one could explain why they had a religious objection to the flu shot. We do have over 11,000 employees throughout the entire state of Arkansas and parts of Oklahoma. But way back, even when we had instituted an annual flu shot mandate back in 2009, we had employees that would have religious objections. But when we ask them what that objection was, what's the doctrinal reason, what's the scriptural reference, what's the moral implication, rarely could that employee or affiliate actually explain what it was. It was assumed there was a religious objection, but in reality, we could never find, we could almost never find them. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. There are actual religious, there's a very few religious groups in the world that have theological or moral objections to different specific vaccines.
Yeah. The headline is "Why Many Adults Cite Religion for Vaccine Snub." What are some of the answers you explore?
One of the first things, and I discovered this from a study, and I'm sorry I can't cite it, about 7 years ago, that was done by the Pew Center related to vaccination, religion and vaccinations. And more specifically, there was a recent study that came out a few weeks back from the Public Religion Research Institute that looked at different religious groups and the faith groups in the United States and how they felt about vaccinations. So they the most notably they asked Roman Catholics how vaccine resistant they are. 73% said they were accepting of the vaccine. 28% said they were hesitant or definitely wouldn't. But then when they talked to self-identifying white Roman Catholics who rarely attended, the numbers changed to 67% accepted, 33% rejected the idea of vaccination. That type of phenomena really becomes apparent when you look at different types of mainstream African-American Protestants, where you see of self-identifying mainstream African-American Protestants that attended church, 57% were accepting, 43% were not. But of the same group that seldom or never attended, that was 43% accepted, 59% not. Now for the big one, self-identifying white evangelical Protestants. Of the ones that regularly attended services, 43% were vaccine accepting, 57 were not. Of the ones that didn't, 48% were accepting, 51% were not. Now, what we see from all of this is of those religious groups I mentioned, there is a higher percentage that is vaccine reluctant. Now, these are all groups that don't spend a lot of time preaching about healthcare from the pulpit or talking about healthcare issues from the pulpit. But you see a higher ratio of vaccine reluctance among people that identify with that faith group but don't go to church on a regular basis. It's more what the Pew Center saw many years ago and the Public Religions Research Institute saw recently is it's more of a theological education problem. We don't know why and what we believe. Therefore, when we are faced with the question, do I get a vaccine? Our response is, well, my religion is opposed to that. Mm-hmm. And that individual may actually not know what their religion has to say about it. Yeah. So for many years, you know, for a couple of years, I had the opportunity of sitting down with people who were vaccine reluctant. And I would ask them, okay, if we're happy to respect a religious objection, what exactly is that rejection? And when I sat with them, oftentimes they would say, they would give me an explanation. And then when we went to look at the scriptures, it wasn't there. Or they would say, well, my religion believes in healing through prayer. And then we would have a discussion over previous vaccines that the individual had gotten or other types of healthcare intervention like mechanical ventilation or hemodialysis. In those cases, it becomes a consistency problem. And I would sit with them and we would work through what exactly do you believe? Not just what do you believe, not just what does your preacher say? What do you believe? Okay, why? And when we sorted it out, there are very few Christian groups in this country that actually have a theological or a moral objection to the vast majority of vaccines on the market.
These days, I tend to assume politics is behind pretty much any such statistic.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that. I was talking with my wife last night, and I don't know why this didn't hit me before, but if you go back to 2019, and I'm not trying to be negative towards President Trump, but one of his big agenda items at, I believe, the 2019 State of the Union was pushing for a right to try law, which would be legislation passed by Congress that would allow people with end-stage medical conditions that were facing, that had terminal conditions, that they could try experimental drugs without being part of an experimental research study. The same folk who push for that are also a lot of the same folk who are on the vaccine hesitancy side, arguing that the COVID-19 vaccines are experimental, which becomes what I think we hit upon when you talk about politics, because we do see a divide between Republicans and Democrats. The vast majority of Democrats, I think less than 7% of registered Democrats are classified as being vaccine hesitant, where almost half of Republicans are vaccine hesitant. It's kind of hard to not say there is a political divide, especially when you look at the religious numbers, knowing that a good portion of Catholics and mainstream Protestants are Democrat and Republican. Where a high percentage of white evangelicals are Republican.
Monty, knowing that background, are there strategies to lessen the divide in the interest of public health and the common good? I mean, these are values deeply ingrained in all of our religious traditions.
Right. I think one of the things, and I preach about this all the time at the hospital, is us in public health and the Center for Disease Control and the NIH, the Food and Drug Administration, and both President Biden's and President Trump's administration. Our public officials don't do a great job of doing public health education. And then that doesn't then translate into, in the pulpit, our rabbis, imams, and preachers, they don't do a great job of actually explaining any of this stuff. My wife, and I always tell her frequently, said, no, people don't read my columns at Good Faith Media because I'm the smartest guy. They read it because I'm not very smart, and I can and I take these complicated statistics and make it so someone who's a college freshman and a sophomore can understand it. I think we as faith leaders are doing a poor job educating the public, saying, this is what's going on. Here are the facts. Here, let me give you the CDC and the NIH websites. So when the public is hit with the question, do I get a vaccine or not? They go to their emotional response, which is often an uninformed religious response, and more frequently than not, it's a political response.
Marty, you also recently wrote about fear-based resistance to scientific research. What should we be considering when we think about preparations for the next pandemic and the one after that?
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up. Not to do self-promotion, but one of the things in my columns for Good Faith Media, I always like to tell historic stories. So I talk about the Russian flu from the 1800s, the 1918 H1N1 flu, the H5N1 flu, the polio epidemic. One of the big problems that we keep making as society globally is we face these pandemics and we do the same stuff over and over and over again. One of the folks that I work with thought it was hilarious. They read one of my columns and they're like, are you telling me this fight over masks happened in 1919 just like it is today? Is this fight over social distancing? I was like, and if you look at the history of the 1918 pandemic and us, they almost had the same fights in the same months as their pandemic progressed. We keep doing the same stuff over and over again. There was a big, the U.S. government did a big study following, and I'll mess the date up, the 1956 or 1954 flu pandemic, looking at how can we improve things next time. They did a big old study looking at that, and it sat on the shelf. We did a big study following the the 2008 H1N1 avian pandemic, and it sat on a shelf. Literally, at the beginning of this pandemic, I sat in meetings going back to February, March, and April stating, we have a problem. What are we going to do about allocation of resources? And many professional ethicists had to go find emergency disaster plans. So in answer, all of that to answer your question is, we don't pay attention to anything we did in the past. We need to seriously look at the last three global pandemics and say, what can we do in the future? Because in 10, 20, or 30 years from now, when we have the next global virus that we don't need to have a debate over social distancing, wearing masks, we don't need to have a discussion about whether it's okay to have a vaccine that we tested it with the use of stem cells that go back 70 years. We need to take what we learn in the present and make sure we have a real plan for the future that the public understands.
So where do religious ethics come into conflict with science in these realms?
Well, my father is ran a hospital lab for decades. And so when he and I talk about science and religion, and he's a very religious individual, I always hate talking about science versus religion. Because I think it gives us the wrong impression that science is against religion and religion is against science. But a lot of times that question of how do our religious ethics get played out? And just to give some easy illustrations, there are actual religious objections to medical interventions that are scientifically based. I talk with the hospital liaisons for the Jehovah's Witnesses every week. We'll talk about a case, or we make sure they're folks. They have a legitimate theological argument. Now, I disagree with that argument. I don't read the Bible that way, but I understand what how their hermeneutic and their exegesis interprets those passages. That's their religious position, and I'm willing to respect that and uphold it. With regard to vaccines, there are similar, very rare religious objections that you can run across. In our country during the polio epidemic, when we first rolled out the polio vaccines in the 1960s, it was the Dutch Reform Movement that protested that vaccines would interfere with God's divine providence. Upon reflection over the next 10 years, the leaders of those different groups said, you know what? Just as easily, God's divine providence created the vaccine. And there are very few that still hold that position. But we do run into actual legitimate theological arguments. What I see is it comes down to a theological education. I don't want people to do clinical religious-based ethics like we're in the scholastic period and we're arguing over the number of angels on the head of a pin. But we need to really look at what's our argument, what are the facts. I took my first clinical ethics, bioethics course with Dr. Ben Mitchell, who was at the Christian Life Commission for many years and then recently retired from Union University. While he's much more conservative than I am, he gave me one piece of advice that I'll remember to my grave. Good ethics starts with good facts. And we so often on religious ethics, we go with emotions versus what's our actual religious argument? What are the scientific facts? Where are they in conflict?
You know, I can't separate science and prayers. People who are praying for good health or getting well, it seems to me like scientists would be their friends because these are the people that are going to find the ways in which to answer their prayers. Is that crazy?
Well, I would have to agree with you, and I'll tell you why. So most of my time, I do clinical ethics for our 11 hospitals. Pretty much every day between 2 and 5, I'm the oncology chaplain for the Baptist Health Medical Center Little Rock, and I've been doing that for almost 15 years now. I pray for healing more than probably anybody I know with, you know, half my patients almost daily. And many of them, they'll ask me to pray for scientists. They'll ask me to pray for the doctor. They'll ask me to pray for researchers, pray for pharmaceutical companies that they get a breakthrough. And we also pray that God reaches down. I've seen things over the years that I can't explain. They can only be explained as God's divine hand moving. But then I've also seen miraculous things take place in every month I come to work, I have to look at a doctor and say, we can do that now. And you look at a lot of that, some of these breathtaking scientists that are coming up with new therapies, they are highly religious individuals. I like to remind my university students, I say, don't get bogged down in this science versus religion, because if you go read the works of Francis Bacon, you can read his scientific works, but then he's got this whole other set of stuff that reads like they are theology tomes. He was just as theological and religious as he was every bit a scientist.
Monty, we're out of time. It went quickly. But before we go, what can our listeners do, if anything, to stay informed on these matters and contribute to a responsible approach?
Well, I would say be informed. It bemoans me that our government doesn't communicate with the public as well as I would like. The information is not as accessible as I would like, but the Mayo Clinic runs a COVID-19 information page that literally you can go see how well your state, how compliant your state is with the vaccination. John Hopkins still runs their COVID-19 tracker, tracking infections and deaths. The CDC has a plethora of information about the vaccines. If you want to know all the adverse effects to a COVID-19 vaccine, it's all there. You just have to bog through and pull up the articles and read through that. I tell people who read my columns, I said, look, don't believe me. Don't believe the guy on CNN. Don't believe the guys at Fox News. Go get the actual journal articles from the New England Journal of Medicine. Go get the journals from the Journal of the American Medical Association. Read it for yourself, because most of them can be traced back to CDC studies. Or the pharmaceutical industry studies, which are public access.
The Reverend Monty Self is senior staff chaplain and clinical ethicist at Baptist Health Medical Center in Little Rock, Arkansas. His commentary appears regularly on Good Faith Media at www.goodfaithmedia.org. with which we are currently developing an ongoing partnership. Monty, those things that you've talked about are difficult issues to address, but you have done it responsibly and effectively. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to join y'all today.
Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'd like to share a few thoughts for Independence Day 2021. Oh, say, can you see? Those immortal words from Francis Scott Key sound at the start of every military exercise, major sports event, and state function from sea to shining sea. And so I suppose, like anything else that suffers from overexposure, they are words we all know, but few of us actually hear. The Star Spangled Banner is a curious song, written almost entirely out of questions, played by military bands and sung by soaring sopranos. It conveys a confident triumphalism that has little relation to the origins of the lyrics. It was 1814, and Washington had just been burned by the British. Key was imprisoned on a ship, watching the battle for Baltimore from the harbor, when the vivid images of that terrifying night and the following day compelled him to compose the poem that would become our national anthem. For Key, the questions were existential. Were we going to make it? Were we going to still be there in the morning? Today, the cartoonish nationalistic worship of ourselves as the worthy inheritors of the land of the free and the home of the brave tells me we might know the song, but we never actually hear it. How else on this Independence Day weekend could one possibly explain the unrelenting attack on voting rights in this country, undermining the franchise that so many fought, bled, and died for? Oh, say, can you see that? How else on July the 4th, 2021, could one possibly justify refusing to even hold a hearing about the closest we've come in almost three centuries to losing our Capitol building and the very lives of elected federal officials while they perform a core duty of their office, ensuring the peaceful transfer of power? Oh, say, what about that? Can you see it? How else, when all of humanity has just endured and still endures a deadly global pandemic that has robbed millions of their lives and millions more of beloved parents, grandparents, spouses, siblings, children, friends, neighbors, mentors, heroes, healers, could one possibly make sense of us pulling ever further apart rather than coming together with empathy and simple, once common human decency? Oh, say, why can't we see even that? I don't think any person has the capacity to grasp the immensity of all human suffering. That's why Americans have been able to live comfortably for generations, representing a tiny fraction of Earth's population while consuming a far higher percentage of its resources, all the while aware of millions starving around the globe, yet being themselves able to sleep soundly at night in air-conditioned comfort while a timer silently clicks on the automated lawn sprinkler system. That kind of skill at denial sounds ugly, but it's a pretty universal truth for wealthy countries in the modern world. But now, perhaps inevitably, we seem capable as never before to compartmentalize our own realities separately from those of our immediate neighbors, from people who differ from us by only a few or only one characteristic. everyone except those who are just like me fall into the threatening category of them. And I cannot see how that is in any way sustainable. I don't have the answers. But I've lived long enough to know that no problem can be solved without first acknowledging it. And so first, we have to look bravely and honestly and directly at what we have become. And maybe ask each other, oh, say, can you see? Francis Scott Key finished the Star-Spangled Banner the morning after that fearsome battle for Baltimore. He saw the flag waving triumphantly over the city. He knew there was genuine reason for hope. Friends, we're not in that morning. We are still deep in the night. The acrid smoke of hate and bigotry and supremacy choking our lungs and irritating our eyes. The natural reflex is to close them, to look away, because it hurts to look. But if we don't look, the tragic answer to Key's question will simply be no. No. We can't see. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I would ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what?